Welcome to this week's episode of the Blue Box Podcast. Brought to you by Starburst Magazine, the world's longest-running magazine of fantastic films and television.
Hello and welcome back to the Blue Box Podcast. It's been a while. We've not been on since the Christmas episode. How is everybody doing? It's been a nice break. Welcome to the first of a series of very special episodes that we are doing in the run-up to the new series. Hello, Kieran. How are you?
Hello, I'm all right. Thank you, Beth. I've had a lovely January. Not watching much Doctor Who for a change, though I've been reading a bit of Doctor Who, as we'll be talking about. Yeah, just had a nice month. Went on holiday to Iceland. That was lovely.
Oh yeah, that sounded very lovely. Actually, how was that?
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, saw all the like geysers and tectonic plates and all that exciting stuff. Didn't get to see the volcano, which has been going off, and we didn't get to see the Northern Lights either. We sort of got driven in a coach to a car park late at night and told to look at the sky, but then there was just some clouds.
Oh, that's a bit of a letdown. Oh well. Yeah, it's funny when you have like these periods without Doctor Who on the TV though, because it does kind of make you think of the torture that it must have been in the 15 years off the air. I love the fact that we can't even wait a month, and there are Whovians out there that dealt with a 15-year hiatus. So I just want to like salute everyone out there, all the Whovians that dealt with the 15-year hiatus, because I'm struggling to deal with a month between series. Well, I mean, it is going to be more than a month by the time it actually comes back, but you know. But that is why we are doing a series of very special Blue Box Podcast episodes in the run-up to the new series. We're going to be doing about one a month, and we've managed to line up some amazing guests. So we're going to be talking to several special guests who are involved in the Doctor Who family in one way or another.
The Whoniverse.
The Whoniverse, and people working on Doctor Who projects behind the scenes, such as novelizations, comics, things like that. So we're thrilled to have lined up some very special guests for you. And today's guest...
Today's guest is going to be Esme Jikimi Pearson, who's just written the novelization of The Church on Ruby Road, the Christmas special. And after that, we're going to be doing a little news section, mainly talking about the drama that's been going on about Millie Gibson potentially leaving the show, and a new companion coming on board who's believed to be Varada Sethu.
Yeah, that's the controversy this week. Well, not necessarily controversy, but it's all a bit up in the ether, and we're not entirely sure what's happening with that. So yeah, we're going to be touching on that later on in the show. So our guest today is an author, freelance writer and activist who has entered the literary scene with a bang. In 2018, she was shortlisted for the Penguin Right Now scheme and went on to win the Rivers of London Future Worlds Prize. She then secured a 3-book deal with Gollancz, the oldest science fiction and fantasy publisher in the UK, and had her first novel, The Principle of Moments, published in January. More recently, however, she has been hard at work writing the brand new novelisation of The Church on Ruby Road, and we're delighted to have her here today to talk about all things Doctor Who. So a big welcome to Esme Jikimi Pearson, everyone. Hello, Esme.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here today. That was so funny to listen to. I'm like, oh yeah, I did do all of this.
So yes.
Thank you for such a lovely introduction. That was a good start to the day.
Yeah, it's funny sometimes, like when people talk about you and you're like, yeah, that is me. I'm pretty awesome.
Yeah, I was like, okay, fair enough. Like, that's pretty cool actually.
Yeah, so let's crack on and get into it, I guess. So
yes,
you mentioned in one of your kind of early Instagram posts about the novelisation that you've been a big fan of Doctor Who from a young age, so it was obviously a real honour to kind of get to work on the novelisation because it's a show that you've loved for so long. So could you maybe sort of start out by talking a bit about your relationship with Doctor Who, kind of maybe your earliest memories of the show and kind of what it's meant to you over the years?
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. I've been a Doctor Who fan since I was quite young. I was actually born and raised in Australia, so and then I moved to the UK when I was about 9 or 10.
Nine.
Yeah, and we didn't have any kind of... There was, the TV shows in Australia at the time were just in an abysmal state. It's very much like very simple television when I was younger. Then when we moved to the UK, we sort of moved into my grandma's house, and she only had like BBC and sort of like regular channels. But to us, it was like the most amazing thing ever. And we sort of one Saturday morning when we were, you know, had no friends yet because we'd obviously just got to the country. Me and my sister didn't know what to watch, so we kind of opened up BBC iPlayer and saw Doctor Who. And
the fact
that there was like a good, yeah, there was like a good few seasons. I think probably so we started watching from Christopher Eccleston's season. So probably we watched from about him till about maybe just before David Tennant sort of had his regeneration. And we were just absolutely like hooked and addicted to it. We watched the whole thing. We had like limits on how much TV we were kind of allowed to watch. So we would be so like depressed whenever we were told to like get off the TV and go outside because we were like, no. We watched it over the course of like a few months. And then sort of the episodes that were on BBC iPlayer ran out and we had to start watching it weekly around the time when Matt Smith came on. So I always say he's my favourite Doctor just because he was the one that I grew up kind of like tuning into like weekly.
Yeah.
I absolutely adore Doctor Who ever since then. And I think one of the funniest early Doctor Who memories I have is being at a sleepover with another friend who was really obsessed with Doctor Who. And both of us feeling like really naughty because we were like, oh, should we watch? Oh, God, I can't remember the name of the episode, but it's that World War II episode with the gas masks and the kids being like, are you my mummy?
Oh, The Empty Child.
Yes, The Empty Child, of course. And we both thought we thought we were being so cheeky by putting on this like horrific horror episode. bearing in mind, it's obviously just Doctor Who, and we were both so scared and couldn't sleep that night.
That's so funny.
That's probably one of my best sort of early memories of Doctor Who. But yeah, I've loved the show for ages.
Yeah.
And when they approached me to do a novelisation, I was like, please let me do this. I would just have the best time.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask, actually, because it might sort of seem like the obvious question, but I'm sure there are plenty of people listening who will probably be curious and would love to know, like, how exactly does one, you know, get selected to write a Doctor Who novelisation? How did that kind of all come about? What was the sort of process for that?
Yeah, I've had this question a lot, actually. And before it happened to me, I would have had no clue how to go about sort of like having an opportunity like this. I think it's a very lucky mix of factors. So I think you have to be quite, not even like well known within the publishing industry, but I think you've got to have almost like a publishing profile that fits sort of into the ethos of the show. So in my sort of original work, I write science fiction and fantasy. So that's kind of, you know, that's obvious there. And then I will write space opera as well, which is like a very good fit for Doctor Who. And I honestly don't think that would have been sort of helped me to stand out that much. But and I have friends who've been to Doctor who don't write science fiction. They write contemporary, like sort of just set in, you know, normal days about teenagers and stuff.
Right.
So I don't think you specifically have to write science fiction or fantasy. But in my book there's a character who is a black time traveller. He's very much inspired by my love of Doctor Who. Like the method of time travel is very different and all that kind of stuff, so it's quite unique. But in terms of having a time traveler character who's black, who my sort of dream cast for him would actually be Xu Tigao. I remember when I saw Eric on Sex Education, I was like, oh my God, if there was going to be an actor to play my time traveling character in my book, it would be him. So then when the Doctor Who casting was announced, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I was like, this is insane. Like, is somebody in my head? I was just so happy because I was like, oh my God, I finally, because you know, as an author, the chance of your book getting adapted to be in a movie is like very small.
So yeah.
I felt like I can live vicariously through these seasons of Doctor Who, so that was great. But yeah, I'd done some work with the BBC a few years earlier for a project that never really got off the ground. I was quite like, I was like, oh, that's such a shame. It would have been such a good project. I really hope I can work with them again. And I had a really great experience on that project. And then probably about 2 years later, year and a half, 2 years later, they then approached me again to do a novelization. But I think they're sort of really on the hunt for new voices for the novelization. Mm. Just because I feel like this is kind of like a very new era for Doctor Who.
Yes.
And I think they're, like, I even had a message from someone recently saying like, oh, I can't wait to buy your novelization. My son and I just started watching Doctor Who this Christmas, which blew my mind.
Oh.
I know if you've been in the like Doctor Who like community or fandom for ages, you kind of, it doesn't, I mean, to me at least, it hadn't really crossed my mind that people could just start watching it now, even though that's in hindsight so obvious, you know, yeah. It's on TV. So I think they're definitely like sort of looking to the future and thinking like, if we're going to sustain this like for a new audience and bring it into the future, because Doctor Who's always been very like current and up to date and sort
yeah.
of like future looking. I think they're definitely on the hunt for new talent. So if you want to write for them, it's like the best thing you can do is sort of pursue writing more generally, and then also let it be known that you're a massive Doctor Who fan.
Yes.
And might come calling.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. No, that makes sense.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, and just in terms of like the adaptation process, like what material did you get from the BBC? I mean, I presume you, obviously you had the episode script. Did you get to see any footage? Did you get to have any communication with Russell T. Davies about how to approach the story?
Yeah, so I got the script early, which was such a surreal experience. You got to go through all these like sort of encrypted like files and stuff. It felt very like MI6. And I was like, oh my God, like, I remember I was reading it in a cafe, and then I was like, oh, hold on, am I allowed to even read this in public kind of thing? So I read the script early, which was a very wild experience, because I kind of sat down and opened it, and then it was like The Church on Ruby Road, a script by Russell D. Davies, and I was like, what the hell? Like, it was so surreal to sit there and realize that I had this kind of like embargoed script in front of me that I was just allowed to read. And then also to put my own spin on, which came with its own host of kind of like, oh God, like, I really hope I do this justice whilst also bringing my own voice to it. And then I did get to go into the BBC offices and watch the episode.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember when that was. I think that would have been about, I can remember the day it was quite warm, so I think it was probably in about September-ish.
Hmm.
Or, no, I think September or August-ish. But, yes, I got to see it quite far in advance, which was so interesting because there was quite a few things about the episode that were different when I watched it. So, like,
the scene
with Snowman, you know, when they're in the sort of snowy street in Manchester, that wasn't in it. That was filmed a lot later, which I feel like is quite common knowledge. But when I watched the episode, it wasn't in there. So then I'd written actually the whole draft of the book by the time the scene got added. So then I was sort of, you know, my editor at the BBC emailed me and was like, right, we've got this new scene in, you need to put it in, here's the new script, da 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 da, and it all had to be turned around in like a week or something.
Which was
quite crazy. Yeah, and when you're writing like novels, the lead up times and the time you get to do things can be quite big, like multiple weeks or months or years even to write a book. So to have to turn something around in like a few days was definitely a new experience. But I found it quite energizing, and I felt like I was like working in the TV world, which was fun. But yeah, even when I saw the episode, there was no CGI yet. So the funniest part was having to sort of write that scene where Ruby and the Doctor kind of break through the clouds and see the goblin ship, which was very well described in the script. But then when I watched the episode, it was like almost like a brown rectangle just like floating in the sky. Which was also made me have, again, so much, it really highlighted the skill of the actors, because their faces are just like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen, but there's nothing there. And the other funny thing that I thought was when the goblin hands are sort of moving things, like at one point I think a goblin moves a coffee cup, it was just sort of like a stick pushing it.
Right. No, that is interesting. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but it's great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny you should mention kind of things sort of seeming slightly different when they're kind of in a script and written down as well. Because I loved that in the book we sort of get to see a little bit more of, you know, the characters kind of in a monologue and a bit more of a kind of insight into what they're actually thinking than we obviously do on screen. Like, for example, when I was reading the book, there's a really lovely moment, I thought, where Ruby's kind of talking about how, you know, she still wears skirts and tights in winter because she thinks they look great on her. And I thought that was really lovely because you're kind of answering a question that actually the audience might have. So I kind of remember thinking, watching the episode at the time, is she not really cold? And I think that kind of reveals something about her as a character. So I don't know, what was kind of like filling in the gaps and kind of answering, you know, unanswered questions for the audience, sort of something that you had in mind when you were writing the adaptation? Was that kind of, how big a part do you think that sort of plays in the adaptation process? Is that kind of something that adaptations are partially for?
Yeah, I think that's one of the best parts about doing it, because obviously, you know, the script is written by Russell and he's amazing at what he does. So half of me was like, I don't want to really mess with the plot. And also, you know, you can't really change the plot when you're writing a novelization because that's kind of besides the point. But what you can do is really delve into the characters' like inner lives and their thought processes and like how past experiences might contribute to the decisions they're making, like on screen. I think TV, like, it moves so quickly and obviously you don't get that thought process unless someone does a voiceover or something. So it can be hard to sort of understand the motivations behind things. And you kind of think like, oh, I wish I got a little bit more insight into maybe like the emotional turmoil between making, you know, the choice that they end up making and other choices they could have made, and why do they decide to do that? I get that all the time in Doctor Who, not because, you know, I think it's underexplained, but just because I think you're often presented with so many interesting like moral choices or like just kind of like crossroads within an episode where it's like, you know, there's a big decision to make, so how do they kind of like make that decision? I'm always so interested in that. I loved writing the character of Ruby. I found her like surprisingly easy to write, and I think that's a testament to how good the script was and how the script kind of like sketched out a character like for her with like really not that much information, which, you know, shows the work of like a sort of masterful script writer. So for me, I kind of felt like I really did know who she was, and I think a lot of that came down to the fact that she's like such a relatable character in the sense that she sort of has this worry sort of at the heart of things where she's just like, I'm waiting for my life to start. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't know what direction is that I'm going to be going in. And she just feels a little bit kind of like lost in the way that a lot of sort of people do at that age, sort of in your late teens and also your 20s, really. So I think she's a really nice character to have there, especially just because of, you know, with like Gen Z nowadays, there are so many sort of issues that are so unique to their generation.
You
know, it's quite refreshing to have a character who's like doesn't have all the answers, because I think so many of us feel like that. And then again, it gives her a great motivation for going off with the doctor, because if you know, you were feeling like that and someone came along and was like, I can show you all of time and space, you would probably go with that.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's very true about, we've all kind of felt that sense of disconnect to an extent, definitely, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I definitely liked how the book really got into what Ruby was thinking in a lot of places. I mean, one of my favourite moments was when she first sees the Doctor in the club, and I think that's a lovely moment in the episode, but it's a very visual moment, and I think you do capture that really well in the description. I think you say the club lights reflect off him like a galaxy living off his skin, which is just a really, really lovely phrasing.
Thank you. I had a really nice time writing that scene. I thought that was probably one of my favourite scenes in the book to write. But I was so stunned when I saw it in the episode. I felt like all of us were, because it was just like, oh my gosh, like what a beautiful, like, happy, and what a beautiful sort of like moment to include in the show. And I think it shows like such a fun, do you know what, it's so funny because I always want to say like such a fun new direction for Doctor Who, but I feel like that scene really isn't out of place or in sort of like the show. And it, while it is like a new direction, it kind of just feels like we're further down the path of what Doctor Who has always been about. So I love that scene. It's just like a mission statement of like, this is what we're sort of like doing now. This is where we are. I thought it was so nice.
Yeah, yeah, me too. I also thought another interesting detail in the book was you get some of, there's a little paragraph about Ruby's family's backstory, about how Cherry arrived in Britain on a ship from Jamaica, and that's not in the episode. So I was wondering, like, because that's quite a big thing actually, to add backstory to the companions' families, their family story. So was that your input, or is that something that came from Russell?
No, that was totally my input. So I know one of the things people love in novelizations is kind of like little details here and there, or I think in some novelizations there's whole scenes that sort of weren't in the show. But that was very important to me to include, because I had a very personal connection to that story because my own grandma was Jamaican. She's passed away now, but she was Jamaican, and sort of had a very similar story to Cherry's story. I definitely grew on personal histories for that, but it just felt so lovely to be able to do that within a Doctor Who book. Like, that's quite crazy to me, because I would have thought if I was going to explore that in fiction, it would be through sort of original writing, and might have to be in like, you know, quite a literary book about sort of like the Windrush generation or something like that. But it felt very healing to be able to bring that aspect of my own background and my grandma's life to a show that I've just loved for so long. So yeah, that was all my input, and I was very sort of grateful that my editor and the BBC let me keep it, because obviously the books have to go through about like 5 different levels of checks and stuff.
Yeah,
and things got cut, like at one point, it's so funny that you mentioned Ruby's like skirt and tights, because I had another line about it which was like,
right, kind of fun.
Yeah, I was trying to I said something like she was like a teenager, and then I listed a bunch of things that she did, and one of them was like she still like dyed her hair with dye from a box, because that's so relatable, like so many times you still do that, like no one can afford to go and get like a full like balayage and just a chain. So I was like, this feels so true to her character, but that got cut because it was like potentially like rude or something like that. Which I get, but it was so, you know, not everything that you add in will make it to the final copy. So I thought it was really nice that sort of stayed in.
Yeah.
It felt like a very true to life sort of explanation of how Cherry would have come to the UK and what her life might have been like. And it's something that, you know, so many people of that generation experienced. So I thought it was really nice to be able to highlight it in a Doctor Who story.
Definitely, definitely. And that's so lovely that you kind of had that, you know, personal connection, and you were able to keep that in. That is really nice, and that follows on quite nicely actually, because I was going to say, you know, obviously Russell T Davies's new era of Doctor Who is obviously placing a very big emphasis on representation, and you're obviously, you know, a big advocate for diversity and inclusion, and I was reading, obviously you've done a lot of work around that with your organization Impact of Omission, so I just wondered if you could maybe sort of talk a little bit about that and kind of what that involves, and also sort of how important, I mean you've already sort of touched on it there, but you know, how important you think representation and inclusion is for, you know, a big kind of cultural institution like Doctor Who.
Yeah, so Impact of Omission is like a sort of initiative that I started with a friend a few years ago, and it was basically about we basically ran a petition to Parliament that was about making teaching about Britain's imperial past like mandatory on the national curriculum, and it was sort of a big campaign to diversify how history is taught in the UK, and not even to diversify, but sort of like the name of the initiative, Impact of a Mission, kind of gives the full story, which is that I believe there's a huge impact to kind of essentially like lying by omission when you just do not include things in the curriculum that are historical events that happened, and not just happened, you know, in some faraway place, but that happened in a faraway place and directly impacted the economic state of the UK, you know, directly built up the UK as like one of the international like superpowers, which then sort of, you know, that's basically the bedrock that our entire position as a modern nation rests on.
Right.
And also it's the bedrock which a lot of the social inequality in the UK rests on, and like sort of attitudes towards people from other countries rests on. So I just feel like, you know, we can't really make claims about wanting to be like a tolerant and equal society if we aren't educated about why we aren't one already. Because you know, if you lack that context and that historical knowledge, it's very easy to just be like, well, I think things are fine. I think everyone's equal nowadays. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of the same thing as being like, well, women aren't discriminated against anymore. I think feminism did its job. And it's kind of like, yes, in many ways we've made a lot of progress from what it used to be like, but I think, you know, we can always do better, and there are many things to this day that still aren't the same. Like obviously the gender pay gap still exists, so until that's done, we've got loads of work still left to do. But you know, just because on the surface it might seem like everything is fine, that really doesn't mean that it is. And I think if we educate people about that, it will become clear to so many people, and we can just work together from the same place to sort of make a more equal society. So yeah, that's what I did with Impact of a Mission, which was a few years ago now, but definitely something that I still think about all the time.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's, you know, so it's such an amazing thing that you've been a part of with that, I think, because I think it's yeah, that's it's definitely true that, you know, I think you do get a lot of people that kind of think that, you know, it's aren't we all kind of equal now, isn't it all sort of, you know, sorted, but there's always that kind of room for improvement, definitely. And it's, you know, you've got to keep moving forwards, otherwise you'll go backwards. So that's really definitely really, really interesting.
Yeah, it just made me think there, like when I think back to my history lessons in school, it was just a bit crap really, how there was so much, you know, Henry VIII and his wives, and you know, we had a bit about the rise of the Nazis, but there was nothing about everything that Britain's done, which you'd think should be part of the focus, really.
No, it definitely should. I mean, the kind of moment that sparked me really thinking about this was that me and the friend that I started with both took history A level. And we specifically did a module that was literally called like industrialization. And there was a sort of a lesson where our teacher started to talk about how like spinning jennies and all that sort of stuff. And then was sort of saying about how that combined with the hugely increased output of cotton that we imported from the United States kind of like cemented our position as like a huge economic force or whatever. And I kind of thought, oh, here we go. Like, we're about to have an awkward slavery discussion. And then she just didn't even like mention it past that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And me and my friend who was white looked at each other and we were both like, oh my God, like, did that actually just happen? And it was it felt so surreal, because I just thought like, that is a key part of the story that you've just told that you've just totally left out. Just from a purely economic standpoint, it should be included to say that the free labor sort of provided by enslaved people kidnapped from Africa allowed us to operate, you know, at a profit that, you know, levels that had never been seen before. That is a massive part of the reason why it was such a profitable enterprise for the US and the UK. And so to ignore that from a purely logical standpoint is just doesn't make sense. And so you think, you know, there's something illogical going on here, which is racism and fear and kind of like suppression of the past, which to me is really scary, because, you know, other people in my class who didn't know about that history missed their opportunity to learn about it. And so, you know, when they become teachers or when their kids ask them questions for their history homework, they will just through no malicious intent, they will not tell them about it either, simply because they weren't taught about it. And then, you know, you'll have people, sort of black people in the UK saying, hang on a minute, like, the way that I live and the sort of generational wealth or the generational trauma that I have is very different to yours. And you'll get people saying, well, whose fault? It's not my fault. Like, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of thing. Like, it's a similar rhetoric that working class people hear all the time. And it's like, well, hang on, there's actually historical social factors that mean I'm in this position and you're in that position. It's not just because you worked harder than me. Like, it's a very much a system at work here. You just can't see it, or you just refuse to see it.
Definitely. That's really interesting, actually, because I think, like, thinking about what Kieran was saying as well, like, it's interesting how, so when I did history A level, we did do about the civil rights movement in America, and we did do about the South African civil rights movement. However, notably missing was anything about, you know, civil rights in the UK, in our own country. So it's almost like kind of, you know, trying to sort of, we're very happy to sort of talk about inequalities in perhaps in other countries and kind of, you know, point the blame elsewhere. But it's kind of a key aspect of our history as well, obviously. So that's interesting.
Yeah. I lived where I grew up. It was right down the road from an old cotton mill. And we went on so many field trips and got told in tedious detail how spinning jennies and water wheels work.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, they skipped the bit where the cotton came from the slaves.
Which feels insane, like, just from a purely, like it's just not logical to skip it out. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
If we're just laying out the facts of, like, this is what happened, this is where we sourced the cotton. Because you know that if it came from, like, an organic farm in, like, Bolivia, they would be happy to talk about it because it's just part of the supply chain, you know? But there isn't a logical thing at work there sort of suppressing the, like, truth of the narrative, and the illogical factor is, like, racism.
Yeah, yeah.
So, no, it's so interesting about how the UK sort of, like, deals with its own past. And I really feel like if we were all just open and honest about it, we would make huge strides towards solving the problem.
So just to bring this back to, like, to the modern day and to Doctor Who, like, what do you think about representations of history in Doctor Who and representations of race? Like, because obviously there have been some episodes that have tried to, like, directly address historical racial inequalities, like we had, you know, Rosa and Demons of the Punjab. Are there any episodes that have stood out to you in terms of addressing those issues particularly well, and how do you think the show can best do that?
I don't know. I think this is a complicated one. As you said, the show's tried to sort of address it multiple times before. I think it's done a fairly good job of it. I think it's definitely sort of one of the more, it's definitely something that needs to be handled with care within the show. I think the best place to come at it from is to be making sure that the people who are writing these episodes are people who have, like, a specific cultural tie to the sort of subject matter that's been discussed, maybe, like, opening up the room to, like a full writer's room of people who can kind of bounce off each other and sort of come to agreements about maybe, like, the direction that they want to tell the story in. Because I feel like, as well, it's a lot of pressure for one person to really tackle these huge subject matters. But, I mean, honestly, I feel like leaning into the ethos of Doctor Who, because Doctor Who has discussed some incredibly dark subject matter over the years.
Like, oh, definitely.
I recently rewatched the episode about, you know, the Ood and their sort of, like, enslavement by the human race. That's a very dark episode. As a kid, it used to freak me out just because they look a bit scary, but then I rewatched it as an adult and thought, hang on a minute, that is very dark. And it's sort of, like, handled with compassion and care, and there are often really, like, beautiful and really moving moments in episodes like that. So I think if it sort of if it came down to it, you'd have to just sort of approach it with the same ethos of, like, love and care that Doctor Who really brings to a lot of its episodes, and with an acknowledgement that these are real people with real histories, not kind of like an alien race. So you've really got to put in your work and do the research to make sure that the facts are being presented as facts. So I think it's a tricky one, but I think I would like to see them tackle, sort of, if not tackling sort of, like, injustices in the past, even just having like more varied settings for historical episodes in Doctor Who, I think that would be amazing. I'd love to see them go right back in time to like sort of like pre-colonial eras in different countries. I think that would be amazing.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, like I think there's such a rich like sort of history of this planet to draw from, and I'd love to see them go into it more. But yeah, I think it can definitely be done. I think it just needs to be approached in the right way with the right care and compassion for the histories being sort of like discussed.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting, and I'm sure with Russell T. Davies's run, we will definitely be seeing kind of more kind of diverse storylines, hopefully in the future. So that'll be kind of interesting to see what different directions they take with that kind of thing. But so with that, Oliver, have you enjoyed kind of Russell T. Davies's reboot, I guess, so far? What have your thoughts been more generally on the 60th anniversary specials and the Christmas special? I mean, obviously, presumably you enjoyed the Christmas special, but what have your thoughts been on this kind of new era of Doctor Who so far, and Shuti Gatwa and Millie Gibson? I know you touched on Shuti Gatwa briefly earlier.
I've loved them. I think they've been so good and just so entertaining. Like, they've really just gripped me. If at times I've not been sure where they're going, like, I had no idea where the Toymaker episode was going to go. I feel like I'm not alone in that. I feel like it was like an episode that just grabbed you sort of and didn't let you go the whole time, which I loved. I thought they were great. I thought that it was obviously so nice to see David Tennant back on screen. I loved seeing him sort of interact with Donna and her whole family again. That was hilarious. That was such a highlight.
Yeah.
Even just from sitting down to watch the first episode, the Star Beast, I was like, oh, like, we're back. This is so fun. To just sit down and watch. And then I feel like we've got a taste of so many of the best parts of Doctor Who with the specials, like going from like sort of intergalactic threat with the Star Beast to then like a much more like sort of like spooky horror on the spaceship. I kind of thought that the sort of bi-generation was such an interesting idea, and obviously it was just over the moon that Shuti was finally introduced, and he just knocked it out of the park, I think, with the first sort of like that last 15 minutes of the episode that he was in, or 20 minutes that he was in. I thought that was amazing. And then the Christmas episode was lovely. I obviously have, like, I'm so biased towards that one, but I enjoyed that so much. And I think Shuti and Millie are just so perfect together. I don't know, something about their like on-screen chemistry and their like friendship.
They do have great chemistry.
They've got great chemistry. I literally was like grinning ear to ear watching them on screen, and I'm so excited for this new season to just see them doing what they do. I feel like they've brought like this really like palpable energy and excitement to the show, which I'm just so excited for. Like, I think this season's going to be such a riot and such a laugh. And it's just going to be like I feel like I'm going to feel like a kid again watching this season, which is just the best feeling ever. So,
definitely.
I honestly couldn't be more excited.
Yeah, I feel like it does feel, I think we said on one of the previous podcast episodes that it does kind of feel like a, with Russell T. Davies being back as well, and he's got obviously got his kind of unique style of writing for Doctor Who, and it does kind of feel like a return to childhood for our generation. We have definitely enjoyed the specials. Very definitely unpredictable. I don't think anyone could have predicted Neil Patrick Harris dancing to the Spice Girls. So that was
I don't think anyone could have predicted that. I was literally like, I remember watching it and saying to myself, like, no, like, surely not. But just being so happy it was actually happening, I was just like, oh my god, this is amazing. I love this show.
it's been absolutely great, I think, what they've done in the specials so far. So yeah, they should be really interesting to see what occurs in the new series. Definitely.
I can't wait for the Regency episode. I've got no idea what's going to happen in it, but it's so funny because in my book there's it, like, the plot with the time traveler bounces between 6066, so like a really far off year in a sort of space opera setting, and a Regency romance setting where my character is kind of like in a Regency romance with the prince. And I saw that they were doing a Regency episode and literally was just like vibrating with excitement. Like, I know that that is probably going to go straight into like my top five of all time. And I also love Jonathan Groff, so I'm just like, oh my gosh, bring it on.
No, I think that episode's going to be great.
Yeah, you mentioned the Regency sort of time travel elements in your book, The Principle of Moments. I think you've said that it's inspired by Doctor Who, who's got a time traveler in it. So maybe could you tell us a bit more about that and like, well, firstly, like how the writing process was different when you're doing your original work compared to adapting a TV episode, and also just give us the pitch for like why Doctor Who fans might be interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so I think Doctor Who fans would love my book just because it's written by a Doctor Who fan, and that's probably quite not because like there's anything too similar with any of the plots. I don't really think there's anything that similar, but they're both in the same genre of kind of like space opera with like more grounded, like Earth side storyline. So they definitely share that. And I also just think if you love kind of like the breakneck pace of Doctor Who and how episodes will just like really land you right in the middle of like a totally different world, then I think, you know, The Principle of Moments would be a really fun read. I think if you want to see a different take on time travel, so the system of time travel in my book is not based around like almost like a time machine or TARDIS like thing. It's very much like a magic system, and doesn't sort of like, it's not really scientific, like it doesn't pretend to be scientific at all. It's just kind of like, yes, it's magic,
right.
Sort of like a few gifted individuals can travel through time basically using objects, special objects.
Interesting.
I just, when I did it, I really wanted to make my own sort of like unique way of traveling through time. And I was kind of really thinking about like what pulls people to different eras and stuff. And I studied classics at uni. So I'm like always obsessed with like ancient artifacts and just like the idea that, you know, when they dig up like a comb out of like a grave or something, that was actually like a comb that somebody used to comb their hair like 4,000 years ago, which is just like mental.
Wow, yeah.
And so kind of the time travel aspect in my book is like, if you find an object that was loved in the past or in the future, you can kind of use that energy to guide the object back there and like take yourself with it.
Okay.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That is such an interesting concept.
Yeah, because you start thinking like, oh, I wonder what, you know, a time traveler might be able to use that I own, like what some of your prized possessions. Like, I've got this locket necklace, and I think if somebody found that, they'd be able to come back to me from the future of the past.
Wow.
I think Doctor Who fans would definitely love The Principle of Moments. And in terms of how writing my own work was different or similar to writing Doctor Who, I love getting inside characters' heads and really writing about like all their deepest fears and what moves them, and just digging into the nitty-gritty of like why they do what they do. So I think that I was able to bring that sort of skill to writing the novelization, because as you said before, it's a lot of just like fleshing out and expanding on their thought processes, because the plot is set in stone. So I thought that was quite fun.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, it was different in a lot of ways, and definitely challenging in a lot of ways, because I wanted to respect the source material and make sure that I wasn't kind of like twisting it too much to fit what I thought the episode should be.
Yes.
Or like sort of trying to justify things that, like, I don't know. It was definitely difficult, because you cannot change anything about how the episode actually sort of progresses and the choices they make. So even if a choice, you know, you're writing something and then it kind of, you're like, right, I've got to move on to this section where this does happen. You can't really be led by what feels natural. You have to... you have to make sure that whatever you're writing justifies the next step in the plot, which I really do not plan my books very much before I write them. So I've never
started
from a rigid outline. So having that structure was actually made me think, gosh, maybe I should start planning my books, because that was like a lot easier to do, because I kind of knew where everything had to go and when and all that kind of stuff. So
it's difficult though, because I do a bit of creative writing as well, and I feel like it is a lot it is a lot more tempting sometimes to kind of write stuff without much of a plan. So I totally get that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. So having to sort of, you know, really steer yourself back onto the track can be hard at times. But luckily it was an amazing story. So yeah. it wasn't that hard.
So is this the first time that you've written an adaptation as well?
Yeah, this is the first time. I would love to be asked to come back and do more. And I'm kind of like begging them, like, guys, get me, like, I want to do more, please. And I know a lot of the guys who've been writing Doctor Who for ages have like a good few novelizations to their name. So I'm hoping that they kind of bring me on as like a somebody who regularly does it, because that would just be like a dream come true.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, yeah. No, that would be awesome.
So you must have had a pretty busy January, because both The Principle of Moments and The Church of Ruby Road have come out at pretty much the same time, haven't they? So, like, what's that been like? And what's next for you? Are you going to let yourself have a rest, or are you working on the next thing?
Oh, I'm exhausted. I'm not going to lie. I'm so tired. So The Principle of Moments came out January 18th, and then I had like a week of like events and like talking to people about it, and just like, you know, all the marketing and everything just like reached like a massive like zenith kind of, and I was like, okay, I feel great about this, like it was all amazing. And then literally I remember I went to sleep, and just before I went to sleep, like a week later, I like woke up and I was like, oh my god, The Church of Ruby Road comes out tomorrow. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna do it all over again.
Oh wow.
And you know what though, it was stressful and exhausting, but I literally wouldn't change it for the world. And I have such a good time promoting books and talking about books that, you know, I really feel so lucky. I would not switch it for the world. But yeah, it was very intense, and obviously I've never released a book before, so to have two come out in the same week was a bit manic. But I keep kind of like waiting for the other shoe to drop and for me to really mess something up. But it seems to have all gone fine. So I'm just like, do you know what? I'm not going to question it.
Seems to have gone more than fine. It was a great read.
Oh, thank you so much. Do you know what? That's probably what I was worried about most, is that kind of like disappointing my fellow fans. I was like, oh my gosh, I hope people like it. But I've had some really nice comments and reviews, and just when I've been on other podcasts, the hosts always say that, you know, they really enjoyed it. So I'm like, whew, okay, seem to have pulled it off.
Yeah, no, it's a great read and a fantastic achievement. It's a lovely, lovely book, and it's great to, as we've said, get more of an insight into you know, the character's mindset and things like that. Having said that, We have to ask, do you have any ideas who the mysterious Mrs. Flood might be?
No, I have no idea. They wouldn't tell me, and they just kind of, yeah, it was all very like, no one would tell me a thing. It would just be like, I would write things in the book and they would get cut, like if I tried to expand on something. So I was like, okay, I think something's going on. But again, I'm not sure, because they were cutting like a lot of stuff. So I have no idea. I literally couldn't tell you. I wish I knew. I wish I was able to give a hint. But they're very strict about what they let you see. Like, I was talking to Mark Morris, who did another novelization. I can't remember which one he wrote. It might have been Wild Blue Yonder, I'm not sure.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, interestingly, we're actually hoping to get him on the podcast. We're in the process of confirming with him to have him on. So,
he was so, when I met him, he was so lovely. And I think he's like obviously like a veteran of the novelization. But yeah, he was saying how him and the other guys who did the novelizations, like, if you were writing the third one, you got to see all three episodes so that you had the context. If you wrote the second one, you only got to see special one and two. And if you wrote you only got to see the first one. So they really lock it down and sort of only, it's like a very much a need to know basis. So guys.
No, we assumed there would be a top secrecy, but we thought we'd ask. We've heard some interesting, some very interesting theories, so we're looking forward to finding out, hopefully sooner rather than later, a bit more information about her. There was some people thought that she might be like a another Time Lord like Susan or something like that. So that's going to be an interesting one to find out who she is.
I know. I was watching it with my mum, and my mum never watches Doctor Who, and she was just like throwing out all the names of characters she knew who like she might be, and they were all just so wrong and funny. I was like, oh my god. And then I got on Twitter and saw everyone's theories, and I was like, wow, I'm so intrigued to find out who's right.
we shall have to wait and see. I don't know whether it will be this series or even the next series actually, so that will be an ongoing mystery. Thank you ever so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for chatting to us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've had such a lovely time. I feel very lucky to be asked on these podcasts. So yeah, I'm always around for like a natter and a chat about Doctor Who. Like, I don't shut up about it in my everyday life. So it feels like a very nice opportunity to have like an official reason to discuss it with other fans. So thank you very much for having me on. I've had a really nice time.
Oh, no worries. Brilliant. Definitely, we'll definitely stay in touch. And you never know if you are able to write a new adaptation in the future, we'll have you on again.
Oh, that would be lovely. I mean, fingers crossed, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Fingers crossed for you.
Congratulations. Yeah, no, we're looking forward to reading more of your work. It'll be amazing to see what else you get up to. So
thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. We shall let you go. Good to chat to you.
It was lovely to chat to you guys as well. Thank you. And I hope you have a lovely rest of your day.
You too. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, Esme.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
You are listening to the Blue Box Podcast.
Oh, that was a great chat.
Yeah, she had a lot to say. That was really interesting. And I do recommend our readers go out and... not our readers, we're not... we do have a magazine, but this is a podcast. I recommend our listeners go out and get The Church on Ruby Road, because it is a great adaptation. And I might as well go and check out The Principle of Moments, because that sounds really interesting too.
Definitely. Yeah, if you've got the time, guys, do go and check out Esme's work and support her, because she's a fantastic writer. So that'll be really... She's one to watch, definitely. So do buy her books and support her if you can, definitely. With that being said, it is time for...
Who knew?
In this section of the show, we talk about all the latest Doctor Who news and controversies that we've discovered swirling around out there. And this episode, we thought we would dedicate the Who knew section to discussing the slight drama surrounding the possible... confirmed, we're not entirely sure, exit of Millie Gibson from the show.
Yeah, it was very odd, because I think it was first reported in The Mirror, and it just seemed very, very much a rumour that Millie Gibson had left the show, had been written out, is the language that they used. And then shortly after that, other websites started reporting it, saying it had been confirmed. Now, nothing's actually officially been said by the BBC, we'll make that clear. But the Mirror also said that the new companion replacing Millie Gibson was going to be Varada Sethu, who you might know from Andor, and she has been seen on set with Shuti Getwa a few days after that story broke. So, you know, there obviously is some truth to what the Mirror said.
Yeah. So there are some people kind of... some people sort of saying perhaps this is history repeating itself. You know, we obviously had the kind of tension between Christopher Eccleston and, you know, Russell T Davies and other creative people on the Doctor Who team back in 2005 and, 2005. And they obviously, it ended up with Christopher Eccleston leaving the show, and there was a lot of kind of disagreements about the way they did it, and a lot of people have been speculating that this is kind of a similar sort of thing, and they've you know, Millie has been, you know, asked to leave the show against her will, and obviously the language used in the article was quite inflammatory, as Kieran said, with, you know, written out and dropped from the show and stuff like that. But and there was a lot of speculation as well that she was complaining apparently about night shoots and the amount of work, which is understandable, to be fair. As a young actress, it must be very demanding.
Yeah, she's 19, and like, I think some people are, well, the Mirror maybe spiked this off, but there was a lot of like people saying on social media that, you know, making assumptions that she's a diva or really difficult to work with, and I've seen some quite nasty language around her, and, you know, maybe she was struggling with the night shoots, but I think you got to remember that she is 19 years old, and Doctor Who is a very intense show with, you know, long shooting hours, and night shoots are hard.
Absolutely. I mean, we also, because I've been watching a lot of like theory videos about it and people speculating on it, and a lot of people have also been saying, you know, there may well have been some tensions behind the scenes, but at the same time, you know, we have to remember that it's because they're filming so far in advance. You know, we might have, it seems strange that she's leaving already, considering that we've only just seen her make her debut and join the show. But, you know, we have to remember that from her perspective, you know, she's actually already been doing this for nearly 2 years already, because they're actually filming so far in advance. And it seems unlikely that this would be like a last minute write out. It would be very difficult for them to kind of, you know, rejig the storyline to give her a quicker exit and refilm things. So it's much more likely that, you know, this is something that was agreed upon in advance, and that she was only ever going to do a specific amount of time on the show anyway.
I mean, it's possible that, you know, it's sort of a bit in the middle, like, you know, she's, after working with her on one season, plans can change a little bit. I don't think she's been like fired in the middle of a shooting day. I don't think it will have been quite that dramatic. And yeah, she has filmed some of season two, hasn't she? So
yeah, I mean,
it is going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Like, if, you know, she leaves midway through the season, or like she has a bit more of a recurring kind of role in it.
Yeah, well, I've seen some people suggesting that, you know, it might be a bit more like a kind of a cross between a Martha and Donna situation, you know, where Martha left, but she came back for a few episodes alongside Donna in series four, and a kind of Amy and Rory situation, where obviously Amy and Rory in series seven were still traveling with the Doctor, but they were kind of living at home and sort of traveling with him on and off. So some people have suggested that perhaps it might be that, you know, she ends up traveling with the Doctor kind of part time for a while, and he also gets a new companion that she ends up traveling alongside, and, you know, it could be, and then she sort of gradually reduces her time with the Doctor until she leaves him for good. So it might be a kind of a bit of a crossover between the two companions, if we are getting a new companion. Obviously, it's not absolutely guaranteed that it's not a guarantee that Varada Sethu is the new companion. She may well just be another character who was spotted filming on the set. So we're not 100% sure. But if there is a new companion, it might well be that, you know, Millie is just kind of travelling alongside her for a while. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of all pans out anyway.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the reason the BBC haven't said anything officially on it yet might well be because there is still a whole full season of Millie as Ruby Sunday to go, and they don't want the news to overshadow that, which is, you know, absolutely fair enough. But it's difficult when they are recording episodes, you know, two seasons in advance.
Yeah, well, I think this is the danger, isn't it, of partially of kind of filming so far in advance, that you don't really want somebody's exit to be being announced before they've even had their, you know, the series air. So I think that's the main reason that it feels a bit strange, because obviously from our perspective we've only just seen her, but, you know, there are plenty of companions that have only been on for one series, particularly in Russell T Davies's era. He seemed to like to shake up the companions, you know, a lot more regularly than in Stephen Moffat's era. You know, we had pretty much had Amy and Rory for the entirety of that era, but I think people forget that back in the original Russell T Davies era, we pretty much always had a companion for only one series with Martha and Donna, and then obviously Bill was later on was only there for one series. So it's not unheard of for a companion to leave fairly quickly.
Yeah, Rose was two series, but she had a switching doctor between them. So every year in that original Russell T Davies era, there is a change in main cast one way or the other.
Yeah.
And you know, I kind of like that in a way. It makes a doctor's life feel longer. Like I thought, like, with the Jodie Whittaker era, because she had Yaz with her like the whole time, it's like that doctor didn't actually live that long.
Yeah.
So it's nice when you have changes, it makes it feel more like an era rather than one story in a way.
I know what you mean. Strangely though, like, if you actually look at this is showing how much of a geek I am, how much of a nerd I really am, but if you look at the kind of chronology of the doctors, strangely David Tennant's doctor is actually one of the shortest lived doctors. Like Matt Smith's doctor is supposed to have been the doctor and lived a lot longer than David Tennant's incarnation, and obviously he had Amy and Rory with him throughout the entirety of his role, I think it just depends on the kind of the actors, the mood of the showrunner, the needs of the show. There's multiple factors that go into it. It doesn't necessarily, you know, immediately have to indicate that there was necessarily any issue between Millie Gibson and other people on the show. You know, it's not necessarily an indication of anything like that. You know, it's the way these things work.
Yeah. I did also think Virata Sethi was really good in Andor. So I am, if she does have a big role in the show as a companion or not, I am looking forward to seeing her.
Yeah.
Seeing her with Shooty's doctor.
Definitely, definitely. I think she'll be a very interesting companion, definitely. If indeed she is the companion, I think she looks there like, I think she seems like a good fit with Shooty Gatwa.
Yeah.
So that's,
she's older than, she's like 30s, isn't she? So that creates a bit more of a dynamic. If she's probably has a bit more confidence, could be more like a Donna kind of.
Yeah.
Donna to his doctor.
Definitely. I mean, that's actually quite refreshing, because I have to say, I do, as much as I do like kind of having younger companions, because I think it makes more sense that somebody who's kind of, you know, in their late teens, early 20s would kind of want to run away from it all and the newfound responsibilities of adulthood, part of me does have a little bit of an issue with the amount of 19-year-olds that the doctor does seem to abduct. And it's just a bit like, it's slightly questionable occasionally. Yeah.
It's a little bit like time-travelling Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little bit. I mean, obviously, it's the doctor, so that's why it's not weird, because we know and love the doctor. But there is an element of it which is kind of like, This girl is 19. She should not be like running away from home. But yeah, it can make a lot more sense, I think, when it's an older companion, perhaps in their kind of later 20s, early 30s, that's kind of got a bit more life experience behind them before they kind of make that decision to go off with a complete stranger. You know, that'll be interesting to see that change of dynamic if she is going to be a bit older.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So. And I think on that note, that is all we have time for today. So thank you again ever so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed our chat with Esme and all her great insights there. I thought that was a really, really interesting conversation, actually, around representation in particular. I was really, really fascinated by that. So we hope you enjoyed that as much as we did. And stay tuned. This is, as I say, the first in a series of special episodes with the special guest interviews that we're going to be doing in the run-up to the new series in May. So as I mentioned previously, we are planning to have Mark Morris, another adapter of a Doctor Who episode, on. And we're going to be having all sorts of interesting people like that. So do stay tuned. And as always, get in touch via social media if you want to share any thoughts, sent, drop us a message. We're always really interested to hear from you, what you thought of any of the points raised in the discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much. And yeah, we hope we'll you'll come back and listen to the next episode in next month.
Yep, we're going to be bringing out one episode a month until the new series. So we hope to see you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.